populism and what's not. Spotlight session, not the gender and populism session, which was supposed to take place here. So it was swapped for some technical reasons. Okay, so let's begin. I'm Erkki Vainikkala. I'm chairing this spotlight session. I shall first present. You're most welcome, gentlemen. Present the discussants here. Emilia Palonen holds a PhD in political science, which she got at the University of Essex.
In ideology and discourse analysis.
In ideology and discourse analysis program. Yes, and she works as a university lecturer at the University of Helsinki presently. And she has studied populism in Hungary and Finland, as well as issues of European identity, cultural policy, neighborhood, democracy, that kind of gamut of issues. She's a specialist in post-structuralist theories of discourse and ideology, just mentioned. She's published in various international journals and article collections. And she's also a member of the Populism as Movement and Rhetoric Research Project at Jyväskylä. And Lazaros Karavasidis is a PhD student in political science at the university.
Master's degree holder.
Degree holder?
Master's degree holder.
Master's degree holder, yeah.
I'm not a PhD student yet.
Okay, well. Well, you're well into it. Yes, anyway, political science at the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki. And his work has been focused on the political and ideological identity of the conservative Greek New Democracy Party. So it's kind of conservative party populism. In its pre-election discourse in 2012 also. And more generally, he has been studying subject formation in national populism in that context, and the construction of people that takes place there, such populism. Halil Gurhanli is working on his PhD thesis at the Department of Political and Economic Studies at the University of Helsinki. His research is empirically concerned with populism in Finland and Turkey. We heard his presentation on the certain kind of theoretical consideration of what is happening in Turkey, with an emphasis on certain theoretical issues. And also he's been kind of comparing such variations of populism, theoretically from a post-foundational understanding, I think we can say. And also considering populism as a deadlock between antagonisms. So after this short presentation, a few words perhaps around these issues for starters. I mean, we have a very clear-cut title for our discussion: what's populism and what's not? But I'm afraid that the answers may be less clear-cut. So we shall let everyone down in that respect, but perhaps that will enhance our understanding. That's the idea. There are many kinds of populism, of course, and we shall try to focus on kind of key issues in what makes up populism as a movement, and also, of course, different kinds of populism and the limits when movements change, transformations in movements. Populism is in many ways a paradoxical phenomenon. For example, I just take the idea of populist rhetoric. In popular speech, often regarded just as vacuous speech, but the kinds of movement to which it belongs and which it propels are something of the opposite. Populist movements are by their very nature expansive and may unite very different social groups and agendas, but in order to do so, they need antagonistically challenged or excluded outsides. They are at the same time strongly inclusive and exclusive. Of course, this might change to what extent. The strength is also their weakness. If they come to institutional power as political parties, they easily lose their drive as movements. But it's also possible for them to succeed in the sense that they turn into authoritarian regimes. They can be left or right, or the confusions of these orientations. The role of ideology has often played down in efforts to explain their formation, but obviously they often have strong ideological elements or host ideologies, as is said, in them, or at least different movements play up different cultural meanings and values. And these, of course, are not all just paradoxes, but even those paradoxes are kind of constitutive, can be regarded as constitutive of the phenomenon itself. So we shall try to get a grasp of these issues and doubtless many others. Okay, I have prepared some questions. They are only my questions. Any questions and comments from the other side of the table are, of course, most welcome. So I hope that this discussion really crosses borders, including this wooden, not an internal frontier, but threshold between us. And my first question, and anyone who feels an urge, then may perhaps first, or the discussants take up this first question. It's a very large question, perhaps too large. Maybe it's the only question we can ask, and the rest of this hour will be taken up by an effort to say something about. There are two things. I mean, when we try to look at what populism is about and its limits, I mean, it's a conceptual issue, of course, on one level, a definitional issue. On the other hand, it's politically speaking, it's a question of thresholds of acceptability and desirability, what we kind of politically, in value terms, may accept and be opposed to. And these two elements, of course, meet in the question of the relationship of populism to democracy. And democracy, again, is an unstable articulation of, to look at the birth of Western democracies, of liberal values, human rights issues, freedoms, integrity of the individual, that kind of thing, on the one hand, and on the other, the sovereignty of the people. And this articulation makes up what we today usually mean when we talk about democracy. I mean, it's not no self-evident fusion of these things. All kinds of things may happen there. And populist movements, of course, come from the side of the people, the sovereignty of the people, but they do so within this democratic articulation. So this is my first question to all of you. What do you make of this? I mean, in your own approach to populism, what you have researched, is populism kind of threatening this unstable articulation, or is it something necessary to keep it going, so to say? This is very general. And you can.
Can I?
Yes.
Start talking
yes.
first. Okay. Well, the debate around if populism is corrective or a threat to democracy.
Yep.
Is a debate that's been going on well nearly since someone first attempted to give a definition of populism, right? What is populism? Can it be compatible with liberal democracies? Can it not? Well, the question hasn't been answered yet, but in my opinion, I believe that there is a dual facade on the matter of populism. We have many cases that populism has been corrective to democracy in certain countries, but in some other cases, populism is a threat to liberal democracy. And what do we mean by liberal democracy? Let me rephrase it like that. If populism is against liberalism or liberal democracy, does it mean that populism is against democracy itself? The answer, in my opinion, is no. I believe that populism can reinvent democracy in other terms, maybe a radical notion of democracy, which will substitute the liberal democracy. The other case is this. Liberal democracies have a certain party competitiveness, and they have certain rules, they have parliaments, etc. The nature of populism presupposes the existence of a certain yet vague definition of people. You know, we have people that will be the major force that it's going to govern, without meaning that they're able to be doing that in some sort of form. You know, there is no definition on how the people are going to have the power and govern at the same time. Well, for example, let's say that populism has been a corrective to democracy. The case of Alberto Breja in Mexico, he was, if I'm saying his name correct, he was the mayor of the Mexico City, I think, for quite some time. He was an extreme populist. His speeches were extremely populist, and his actions were too. I mean, he helped reinvent democracy in Mexico City, and through proper stratification to the people. You know, the people had more power and more influence in charting the course of the mayoral work. And when that man was nominated for president of the Mexico City, he also tried to pass this kind of democracy to a major level, to a national level, without, of course, any success. But the point is that even if he wasn't successful at reinventing democracy in a national level, he did that in a local level, such as Mexico City, which was, I think, really helpful for the people of the Mexico City. The other case, populism as a threat to democracy. Let's not go so far, and we can see Marine Le Pen. She has also been characterized as a threat to liberal values, not just in France, but across Europe. But that doesn't stop her from gaining more popularity day by day. Now, what are the reasons for this popularity? What does make populism attractive, be that corrective or a threat to democracy? I think we can trace the attractiveness of populism in a major crisis, an economic crisis, a political or social crisis. Now, if we can see each case separately, we'll see that there is some kind of crisis that gives birth to populism. And depending on the crisis, there are the variations of populism. And I think we can find in this crisis what kind of populism do we have, be that a threat or a corrective thing to democracy. I think I'm taking over other people's time, so...
Yeah, well, we have enough time.
I'll pass it to someone else.
Yes, okay.
What comes to mind is basically the, at least exactly on that point of being corrective or a threat, there was the Papadopoulos take on public administration and how it is transformed. It was in Menian Sorel's book in 2002. And he somehow, at least what I feel a little bit more sympathized towards, is his take that there is this general declining of Rechtsstaat. So basically the idea of transformation from government to governance that defines what liberal democracy is in an organizational manner. What he means by basically that the case of accountability and transparency, those who actually make the decisions and those we hold responsible in this changing postmodern way of government are not the same people. Those who are going to lose their heads or positions or going to be held accountable are usually not the guys who are giving those decisions. With the inclusion of blackmailing capacity of different participants, negotiation process between different lobbying groups, different interest groups that have no connection whatsoever with the institutionalized way of representation. His example here are like the not only the trade unions, but on top of that, especially the lobby groups of multinational companies, the corporates, different interest groups that are that have a seat in decision making, but they are not, they didn't come there by elections or representation. But this is the reality of the world. Yes. He explains that a transformation from government to governance. Yes. So basically, if we somehow try to understand if it's a threat or a correction to democracy, we need to somehow, and I do agree with his symptomatic analysis, to say that maybe we should look first what sort of responsibilities and what sort of practicalities of government is in everyday politics. So in that sense, yes, it is a symptom, but it is a symptom of a very existential problem that we don't know how to respond to. Our problems are too big. The things that we have to deal with requires the inclusion of different groups, but every single one of them cannot be held accountable for their effect. So in that sense, populism is a response, a simplistic response, but still a response, a symptomatic response to that unaccountability. Yeah. And I find myself, at least to start the discussion with, I find myself a kind of more sympathized to that approach. That it is related to something a lot bigger in the way in which the governance works. Maybe I should just cut it here and try to see how it goes.
And this change from government to governance, that's in fact, I mean, the reality of liberal democracies, although we think of classical liberalism values.
Yeah, rather than
golden value, but then liberal democracy is about this change that you that
rather
you
than the ideals, everyday practicalities of liberal democracy actually makes it a firm ground, fertile ground for a response to come up in the form of different populisms.
Yeah, I would actually answer this by saying that liberal democracy is a threat to democracy, insofar as it reduces politics into these pre-given identities rather than identifications and interests rather than demands, and rationality rather than passions and argumentation, for instance. So populism is a corrective to that. But as also Khalil was presenting here yesterday, if you have pure populism, you end up having a problem for or threat to democracy, because then you wouldn't have any of those demands wouldn't be emerging to the fore. And this morning we were discussing, for instance, Turkish populism through another paper where it seemed that if you have just the polarized frontier, simplification of the political field through populism, it impedes possibility for these demands to emerge. But if you end up sort of having a little bit less populism and more focus on the sort of particular demands, less universalization, more particularism, then you start rebuilding this sort of notion of democracy or in enhancing democracy. So populisms in plural could be a solution here.
Yeah, you mentioned the word universalization. Now if you take this to universalism, I mean, the thing about, I mean, pure populism is a very interesting term because I mean, what is it purified of? If that's a Dakloan kind of definition of populism as a certain kind of social logic, I mean, what if that kind of brings about problems, possibly or potentially? Well, there should there then be something less than this or something more than this, something lacking or excessive? That's a problem, because thinking, for example, I mean, there's so different populist movements. If you think of the human rights movement in the U.S., for example, that's of course about black people who were excluded. Mm-hmm. They were excluded from basic human rights. So the populist agenda, the kind of the empty signifier in a sense, charge was precisely that we need to have what belongs to everybody. So in a sense, this is informed by a universalist liberal idea. And it's very difficult to think that this kind of movement would lead to kind of a new authoritarian government or governance, because it's informed by this kind of a certain universal value which even we want for us, and other people support that. But if you have a kind of movement where the universalizing movement of a certain group is, let's say, more like a power play, so to say, then, I mean, well, this is a bit perhaps confused question, but the idea of, I mean, universalizing, but universalism, what role do these universal liberal values play in this logic of populism and its possible different directions it can take, corrective or threatening? So this is, I think, an important question if you want to look at populism in terms of this kind of liberal democracy issue, which is very complicated.
Mm. Yeah, so just to clarify perhaps that we're not looking at whether or not populism exists, but we could be looking at what kinds of populism exists and to what extent some movement would be populist or not. This is another question that was emerging in this conference.
Yes.
Well, about, you said about the universality of the liberal values, that's not for granted. I mean, populism is a kind of defiance to these values, right? I think at some point, not in all cases, but in some cases it is.
It can be.
Yes, of course. Let's see that there are still authoritarian regimes in all over the world, right? North Korea, for example. Okay, they don't have liberal democracy. They don't have liberal values. So there are some, let's say, some spots that defy liberal democracy and liberal values. And but what what do they intend to give as an alternative? These kind of populist cases, that varies in its case. But as we can see in most of the cases, we begin from a populist perception of that the people should be in power, should have the real power, not the elites, not the political system, not big corporations, etc. But we begin from that and we finish up to being for the power to be concentrated on the leader. Okay, and that is where populism negates itself and it becomes some sort of authoritarian tactic. Okay, when the leader starts to take over and characterizes himself as the true representative of the people. That gives him the, let's say, free pass to do whichever action he wants, he or she wants, in the name of the people, even if that is in the harm of the people.
Well, that's in a sense perhaps a kind of a challenge of populism to itself, because the populist leader is, I mean, in Lacan terms, is the kind of charged empty signifier that charges the movement, and in kind of normal political terms, is in charge of the movement. But it's of course different. This charging investment element is different. And if that succeeds, it's quite possible that it leads to the kind of authoritarian leader. And it seems that the danger is always there. So somehow it seems that there must be something in populist movements that is checking this as such. Otherwise, I mean, if pure populism means this social logic in this sense, it almost inevitably, in principle at least, inevitably, what happens in practice, we never know. Someone might intervene from the outside.
But no, I mean, in practice, exactly,
yes.
we do know. I mean, that's what I try to make in my presentation, and that's the point that I try to make. I mean, it's almost a Freudian twist in the sense that the more groups a populist movement claims to represent and includes in itself, the more elusive the common ground becomes. And as the Freudian logic goes, the ultimate point of it is just one name, which is the leader. But my problem with the take that a leader can do that as if a leader is an active participant of that, it is more or less in the sense that a leader cannot get away from being that. It's not an active attitude of the leader that I want to hold all the power in my hands, as hence authoritarianism comes. No, it's the other way around, as far as I can see, that leader is pushed to the point of being the only unifying power,
yes,
only unifying singularity for so many different groups that can be defined as the followers or the people of the populist movements. And that's why, in the Turkish sense, that I try to give the empirical proof, let's say, or the hints towards that, the case of Erdogan. I mean, he is qualified as a deity. I mean, he literally, in every single speech, members of parliament, supporters, media, patronage, anyone who is pro-government or a part of, a supporter of that group, takes him in his personality as a deity. I mean, literally, as a holy thing. The glass that he drinks from is taken and exhibited in a small museum. I mean, that is a ridiculous case when you think of that. And in public, his members of parliament says that even touching him is a form of prayer. So when you come to such a level of libidinal tie, mm-hmm, with a leader and a follower, it's really, how can I say, oversimplistic to think that it is the doing of the leader. It is a two-way street that actually works in a particular way. And that's why I think from this point, I'm really looking forward to Yannis's key note when it comes to the populism and anti-populism, because it somehow creates a zero-sum game, or actually a ping-pong game, let's say, that the other part cannot avoid from being just anti-populist, or in Turkish case, for instance, just being anti-Erdogan. Whatever that you say just pushes you to that point of being just anti one person. So it's at that point we can maybe stop talking about populism, or maybe not populism, but politics or democracy or anything that is positive about the political arrangements. It is a zero-sum game now, and that is almost universally fixated. And that is the pure populism, as Laclau defines, or many others define in that sense, like everyone has a place and we simply cannot get out of this deadlock. And I think that's the point where it passes even the level of threat to democracy. It just becomes a completely different species. I don't know what to call it. I'm not sure if we should call it populism then. But it is what it is. And I think Turkey is a very good case to think of that limit. Mm-hmm. It's not interesting in itself, but it is interesting for theoretical purposes of thinking, is there too much populism, or can it be a threat?
It is interesting even in itself, I would say. In a way, that's a psychotic moment in becoming the populist leader, when you kind of become a deity. I mean, the position of the king. I mean, there's a certain contextual thing that somebody can function as a king, but if someone thinks, experience himself as a king, that I am really a king. I'm not kind of produced or put into this position where I have to act in certain ways, but I am the king.
Yeah,
so it's a kind of a psychotic moment, and you know this Bavarian mad king who thought that he believed he was a born king. You know, so that's very interesting. Mm. Yes.
Yeah, in a way, populist leader is both vital, necessary, and impossible. Because if we thought with Laclau's theory, we should recognize that they are only temporary fixations, and when everything is sort of encapsulated by this leader alone, as you were saying, it becomes like something else than populism, perhaps. And that we should perhaps see that in sort of in populism, in radical democratic terms, we should look at this kind of one plus. There's something beyond us that is representing us. But this is not fully defined. It can never be fully captured, and it cannot definitely be encapsulated in the long run by one single authority that we would take as a name for our movement. And it's also in thinking of this particular populist movement, which rely on the leader, it's almost impossible for them to sort of say, now your expiry date has passed, sorry, bye-bye Timo Soini, or bye-bye Viktor Orban in Hungary, or so on. So, I mean, how could then this leader wither away in a sort of convenient manner and still retain the movement that they have built or has been built behind them? Are they really only one person? Is Erdogan, for instance, only one person, or is it kind of a puppet of a larger movement?
Many Kekkonens.
Yeah, Kekkonen in Finland would be an example.
Yes.
But I think it also brings back the old, or how can I say, almost a foundational theoretical division within the literature on populism. One, yes, I mean, we seem to adhere to a particular one, which is the, you know, comes from the Laclauian understanding and stuff, but it's also the positivist one, the one that we might remember that actually tries to characterize populism, saying that, okay, populism is a movement where there's a charismatic leadership. Populism is a movement where there's an agrarian revolt or whatever. Positive qualities. And we somehow, with this extreme cases where with the leader question, we somehow go back to that question of, can we actually talk about a particular quality of populism that is positive? Mm-hmm. And I'm entirely confused there of my adherence to a particular theoretical school, mm-hmm. because I'm re-questioning maybe the presumptions that we had. If this road leads to such an extreme case, mm-hmm. like in my empirical case, the Erdogan, maybe those guys were right that I, from the beginning, got rid of the positivists who just claim that there are positive qualities of populism, and at the end of many years of research, you just find out at the end, oh, really, a charismatic leader is a quality of that. I mean, it opens up a new dialogue, I believe.
But this is also a particular reading of Ernst Laclau's work, because when he explains, for instance, many lectures and his work, the Russian Revolution, he doesn't explain it through Lenin. He explains it through the slogan of bread, peace, and land. And so this is this imaginary unity that is emerging, and not Lenin. And when Lenin becomes the symbol, it actually turns into something else and something much more nasty. So that's kind of the end of populism for Laclau. But for some reason, especially with the examples from Latin America, we're used to seeing the leader as the sort of key signifier.
Mm. Well, and in Laclau,
can I comment something on the leader? Because Emilia said that how a populist leader withers away. Well, in our case in Greece, PASOK, the major socialist party, and its leader Andreas Pandreou, who was quite populist, in fact, he did not wither away. I mean, even though he died nearly 20 years ago, a lot of people are thinking of him as a true leader, a true representative of the people, that he put forward the interests of the people against the elites, the Americans, etc. And that transcended, some sort of, transcended into Alexis Tsipras, who many people thought in 2012 that he was the new Andreas Papandreou, the true representative of the people. So I don't think it withers away the notion of the leader, but maybe it transcends, or it stays as a memory within the people that supported the leader.
Yes, exactly, with Kekkonen, the Kekkonen syndrome in Finland.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that called the myth? I mean, you reach the level of the myth in the fantasmatic logic in that sense. You become the myth.
It stays as an idea later. Yes.
Okay. Well, one important issue, of course, is the relationship of populist movements and parties to institutional parties. We try to understand these kind of thresholds. And of course, populist movements, they become parties, they get parliamentary seats, they become institutionalized. I was wondering, because you studied the new democracy thing, I mean, that's how does populism actually work in that connection?
Yeah.
It is kind of ideologically conservative to start with. There's a kind of ideological charge in it.
Yes,
say that.
It was, well, let's say that New Democracy is the major conservative party of Greece. It was, I think, in the period from 2010 to 2012, it was a period that New Democracy, experimented with populism due to its leader, Antonis Samaras. Now, it was quite an unorthodox way for that leader to be populist, since he tried to combine populism with liberal and neoliberal values. Well, that didn't go well as expected, and in that 2-year period, populism took over the party. I mean, it was his speeches were rather populist, his actions not so much, but that was due to the fact that New Democracy was and is an old party. So during the crisis, it kind of lost its original legitimization. And well, that populism contributed to the further deterioration of the party. I mean, it was around before the regional elections of 2010, the party was at, I think, 35%. And 1.5 years later, in the May 6th elections, it was 18%, nearly half. Which shows that populism in that case, and within the specific institution, such as a conservative party, did not work as well as its leader thought it would be. So in that case, it may be problematic. In the other case, in the case of Syriza, we saw that populism kind of enhanced the power of the party. But maybe, I think, in my opinion, it was due to the fact that Syriza did not have any actual losses from the crisis in a political level. It was just a small party before the crisis, and it gained popularity due to it was one of the few alternatives for the people to vote. So we see two distinct cases in which populism diminishes an old party, an old conservative party, and the other cases, it makes a small party a major player of the political scene during the crisis.
Okay, so this element goes different ways.
Yes. I believe so.
Yes. Okay. Because Syriza is such an interesting case, because, I mean, Syriza, of course, really betrayed the people, I mean, in the election, and said so, I mean, Tsipras then gave in after getting the vote that he wanted.
The last year was quite adventurous, so we're still working on what exactly happened.
Yes.
So did they betray the people?
I think so, yeah.
Anyway, what did the people want?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's it, yes. You wanted to say something?
No,
It's...
But isn't that the point of representation? I mean, you just give your blank check. I mean, that's the problem with the intervals of elections.
Mm-hmm.
Not the constant check, but the interval check. Like, you do it once every 4 years or 5 years. It is basically a blank check that, okay, it's a particularized trust.
Mm-hmm.
I do trust you, you will act for my interest, and we will see. So what do people want is in the sense that I want you to decide. It is a very particular way of giving your decision right to a group of people. And if they decide in a particular way, like Tsipras and people around him decided, Syriza decided, I mean, you gave me a check and I did everything in my power and this was the only solution that I could come up with. Mm-hmm. Sorry, maybe you think that I betrayed you, but no, you just trusted me and I did my best. And I couldn't do anything better than that, so I'll find somebody else then next time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean? That's the logic of interval problem. And like in places like Poland or Ukraine, you just have this immediate actions that if your representative act in a particular way that you don't approve, there are institutional mechanisms to pull them back. Okay, you are released from your duty. Since we do not have it in this particular case, it gives an opening space for the trust and the representative to act in certain ways. And we just give them that right. That's the way of representative politics works. And it is a very particular, again, it's a very peculiar problem that we just want to be on top of them all the time. The moment that they do something wrong, we just want to hold them accountable, pull them back. But as I try to make reference to Papadopoulos in that sense, I mean, they are not always the guys who make the decisions. Things are a lot more complicated than that. And they are the guys who lose their heads. I mean, they are the guys who just said, you're the traitor. Nobody says it to other people who are actually involved in that whole process of negotiations. It's Bufarakis. I mean, he just noticed that and he left the government. I mean, he left the party, he left everything. And I mean, he's doing something else entirely now.
But well, what happens on the street, it's interesting, there was a story, Helsingin Sanomat, the leading Finnish newspaper, on the journalist who was in Athens, and he had been there when this election took place, and now again. And now there was a demonstration with the difference that it was against the pension cuts. But there was no big support. I mean, the earlier demonstration, it was all for Syriza and against the kind of European Union in whatever they wanted. Now it was against a certain thing, but no support for Syriza. So that has disappeared in his view, what he saw on the street entirely. So it's very interesting. I mean, where is the support? It's kind of,
I mean, in the points of crisis, basically giving in to cynicism is just one step. I mean, it just happens. The moment that you feel that thing, I mean, what's the point of coming up again? What's the point of coming up if I'm going to be... I mean, it's, how can I say, the phantasmatic logic that tries to explain that on the... I mean, from Žižekin perspective, it's basically like a broken-hearted lover. Okay, I cannot believe in love once again because my heart is broken heavily the last time, so you just completely disattach yourself from any kind of engagement because you just are too afraid to be broken again.
But this is also then the moment when another populist movement might emerge and reclaim your love and somehow re-establish it. And I was wondering when you were speaking, so I've been interested in local democracy and new forms of democratic engagement, like how would our notions of populism for like the positive side and the negative side of populism work there if we looked at something else than electoral democracies.
Does anyone? Yeah.
If I can make a comment about Greece, I think we should not forget that in the Greek case, first of all, there were two elections. There was one election in January in which Syriza got the mandate, and then after the failure of the negotiation, there was another election. And what is very striking is that Syriza got exactly the same percentage in both of them, which has to make us a little bit skeptical about what exactly the mandate was originally. And we know from following the event, but we also know from research on polarization and data we have that the mandate was very paradoxical, because the mandate was, we definitely want to stay within the European Union, but at the same time, we don't want to stay there.
Okay.
So it was very paradoxical, and to a certain extent, I think that Tsipras did not betray that. He was very loyal to that. I mean, if there is a problem, it's that he was very loyal to that. And of course, he was rewarded in the second election, but that did not create a better situation for the country. And one more point, because I think it's very interesting, and Khalid's point about the leader, that there's a paradox there also. And I think that even in cases, there's a structural inverted commas role, which is neither controlled by the leader himself nor by anybody else. And this is also the case, for example, in the example of Chavez in Venezuela, who is supposed to be the most one of the most strong leaders that we have available in the last few years, and there is a whole new literature, new ethnographic literature on the analysis of social movements in Venezuela. And there's a very interesting book that I will mention because the title is very striking. The title is We Create Chavez. And the argument is that actually Chavez was not controlling his own figure. So a lot of movements that were operating at the grassroots used Chavez. I mean, it was a two-way relationship. But they also used him in order to reinforce their bargaining power within decision-making processes and so on and so forth.
Like Perron's word.
Yes,
in a sense,
these are all very interesting examples. They're much more complex than we actually initially think.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's the populist logic in that sense, even when you're against that figure, to think that, okay, he is behind everything. You just totalize, but you just elevate him or her to the level of a myth. It is impossible for Chavez or Erdogan or any leader to somehow have an effect on individual decision on so many levels. Mm-hmm. But it is, as you said, it becomes an inverted tool for different groups that is somehow utilized in every single case. So it's, again, to use a maybe a weird analogy or unusual analogy, it's basically like a celebrity. That a celebrity that becomes the name and different groups just use that person as long as you can get something out of it. And basically it just ends up with the consummation, the complete consumption of that figure. In certain cases, death awaits them. Basically we just consume them and just finishes drugs or whatever. But it's the same with the leader in that sense. We should somehow normalize our view of it, even if we are against that person. Mm. And that is the poverty of anti-populism in that sense.
Yeah.
And in the sense that, like, tacitly recognizing the ultimate power of that personage, and it creates the circumstances, no way out circumstances where we cannot find a way out other than just killing that person or just eliminating that person.
And if it's a collective deadlock, it can be the start of a civil war.
Exactly.
And if you simply eliminated that person, then of course it would be possible that from behind there would be somebody else taking that position, because as you said, the person wasn't alone. But then I'm thinking that shouldn't we, in sort of like more normative terms, shouldn't we try to pluralize these populist movements so that we would see that there would be more than just one single male head figure, usually male, not always. And should we not like show what is the richness behind this movement? And now we're just like trying to articulate this kind of very hierarchical, often chauvinist vision of populism, and instead we could be demonstrating its wealth, and that could be the real strength of the movement. So if you would have like a common goal, let's take the M25 as an example. Here I find it very exciting because they do have a concrete goal. It's simple idea, etc. But what I find very problematic is that it's centered around Varoufakis, and when you go on the website, there's the same list of celebrities all the time. So if there would be if it really would be a movement that is appealing to, I don't know, at least grassroots intellectuals, this set of intellectuals at the top would be changing every time when you go and log on. But no, it's still in this kind of hierarchical picture. And greetings to anybody watching. Could you do something about it? Oh, there's another question.
Over there. Yeah.
I have a question to all panelists. If you accept that populist, you could use this family metaphor. You have a strong father or mother who take a decision in the family, and you have a children, it's like the members of a party, and you don't choose, or you don't have liberal democracy in the family. It's a natural thing to, you have the same interests, and you could also use metaphor for the small firm entrepreneurship. The leader, the entrepreneur, is both owner and worker in the small firm, and they have common interests. There are no conflicts. They don't choose the entrepreneur. I think what consequences, if you accept this type of metaphors, what consequences do you conclude from your discussion about populist democracy, not democracy, liberal values, and things like that? Could you give me some hint of how you look at it? This is a very usual metaphor for populism. The
well,
family metaphor.
Well.
Why?
What?
Why is that? Why should the family be a metaphor for populism and not for another?
Because you use, populists often use this metaphor for the whole political system. That is, they are their so-called image of the political system, so to say.
But where's the dynamic of populism in that? Because I mean that's a kind of a functional totality where everybody does
has a place.
Everybody has a place.
That's more like authoritarian regime's definition of society. You can very well see that Mussolini.
Or Stalin.
Yes. Exactly. The father figure or the mother figure. It's I think that if there is one thing that we should avoid, we might think of anything that we like about populism or what sort of approach that we take, but if we're gonna avoid one kind of relationship, and it is that we simply cannot accept the fact that, or accept the idea that populism somehow sees the society on that level of authoritarian relationship. It is completely a different regime, a different logic where everything has a place, and it is a lot more like authoritarian ones than populism. This doesn't mean that populism cannot turn into an authoritarian regime, but we simply cannot, in my understanding, we simply cannot define it that way. It would be a wrong analogy.
It would be kind of internalized power relations. I mean, not necessarily authoritarian from the look of it, but functioning as such. Yes.
So perhaps we don't subscribe to this metaphor, but I like the metaphor. I thanks for the question. I think it's interesting and thought-provoking, because I started thinking of George Lakoff, who's written about moral politics in the US, and I thought that populism could equally be of this strict father type of populism and nurture and parent type of populism, and I think that we could see this if we start analyzing types of populism, we could also use these metaphors. But then also I thought, considering the firm, it's really nice because nowadays there's so much of discussion, especially in Finland, that we should all be entrepreneurs. So it ties nicely with this sort of emergence of populist movements. And I think in Sweden, where you're coming from, it would be kind of the same thing. So these feed each other, these two trends, sort of, Sverigedemokraterna and then this entrepreneurship. But you know what is the sign of a successful firm or successful political party?
No.
It's when you can leave it to somebody else to take care of. So that's the moment. So if this is what I've been talking about, so we should try to see populist movements as something else than fixated on the leader figure. So also your firm, my firm, would be doing much better if one day somebody else would be heading it. Or, of course, that's also the logic of selling your firm and making a lot of money. I don't know whether that works.
That's
politics.
A long way. Yeah, okay.
Or movements, for that matter. Yes. And that's there is real problem that political movements also are somehow institutionalized under specific leadership. And in order to rejuvenate themselves, they should really try to change their leaders. So. institutionalized the change in the structure of the movement.
Well, if I can comment on that, the question. I also don't believe that, a populist leader can act as a patron or as the father figure that will see the society as its protege. I think it's most common that the leader poses himself or is interpreted as a servant of the people, which means that he is not above the people, but he is one of us, and he just has a mandate to do the job that we can all of us to do. So yes, I agree with Stavrakakis and Khalil that it's more common, the fatherly figure, it's more common in authoritarian regimes, such as Stalin and Mussolini, for example. That's all.
Yeah. But I mean, we soon have to stop this. But I mean, in the course of your research, did your notion or did your conception of populism change? When you started out, did you have a kind of certain idea of what populism is about, generally speaking? Or when you started studying a certain populist movement, did that lead kind of from bottom up to a different conception of populism from perhaps what you read in On Populist Reason or something like that?
No, I mean, for me it's obvious that my adherence to the particular set of theoretical tools and tools and conceptual tools that post-structuralist view offered, somehow my adherence to that decreased over the time that
decreased,
you see. Yeah, of course. I mean, try to see things in a more multiple way and trying to include other views, and especially when I gave the example of Erdogan and stuff. So basically, I see it, I find myself in almost complete opposition to Laclauian take that it has almost an intrinsic revolutionary potential that waits to be realized.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow I hope that populism is the way to create revolutionary emancipatory politics and stuff. It's I see it the complete opposite, more or less, when I come to the point where I can see the potential realizing into a cult of leadership, let's say. So yes, it is a very useful diagram to think of that. Yes, there is a shape or there is a dimension of populism in every sort of politics, but in my research I have seen that at the end of the day there is such a thing as too much populism, and that doesn't resemble something that we would like to adhere to, something revolutionary, emancipatory and stuff. So in that sense, like, I think mine, at least, my personal experience, has changed immensely.
Okay, what about you?
Since I haven't done the research that you have done in your research academic field, well, I can say that I'm nearly on the path that Khalil is, but I can't exclude the fact that populism can be good or bad. You know, it depends on the case. And as we already know, there are a lot of cases that prove both of these things, that it can be a good thing or a bad thing. Which leads me to say that I can't stick to a particular conception about populism. You know, each case is different and may have to be interpreted in a different theoretical framework. So we shouldn't be stuck in, Laclau's version or Mood versions or any particular version, but we should have as many theoretical conceptions as possible. We do have, after all, but we should interpret each case and we should consider each case with its particularities, its cultural perceptions within its country, separately, etc., etc.
Okay. What about you?
Well, even if I was doing my PhD back in the day at Essex, I didn't study populism. I realized 11 years ago that Erasto's theory can be used to explain political polarization in Hungary. year later I defended my thesis about that and published something on competing populisms and polarization. And I also think that as I didn't have a fixed idea in the beginning, I have been able to then re-articulate this theory and sort of develop it towards this dynamics and towards questions about like what is the extent of populism, etc. So, and also link it to other, for instance, Lakoff's notion of moral politics. So it has. I think we should not just chuck something like a theory if it doesn't fit exactly or if we are not satisfied with the political results, but we should be trying to work on it for a better understanding of populism.
Work theoretically on these different takes and why we work on empirical things.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good ending. I wanted to take up the question of resentment as one force behind populism, but perhaps fortunately we have no time for that. So I want to thank everyone. I think this was a good kind of wrapping up of the thing. So thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot.
And thanks, Erkki.